Biblical leadership. And I want to preface the lessons. Notice I said lessons. I don't know how many there's going to be. I can't give you an exact number. But I want to preface the lessons by saying that biblical leadership, what we mean by that is servant leadership. Okay, so throughout the lessons, I want you to hear servant leadership, because that's what biblical leadership, whatever leadership form that is, whatever type of leadership that is. What I want to do, our text this morning is going to be taken from Mark chapter 10. So go ahead and grab your Bibles if you would and turn to Mark chapter 10. I love the Gospel of Mark, the shortest gospel. And what I love about Mark is it so quickly gets to the point of what Jesus was all about. It literally, matter of fact, immediately, depending on your translation, right? Immediately is the key word. Some 40-something times in 16 chapters. Because what's happening is these things, whatever, whoever Jesus is and whatever he's setting out to accomplish, is happening immediately. He knows what he's going to do. He knows what his purpose is. We know that's the cross, right? That he's going to die. He's the atoning sacrifice for the sins of the world. But what I like about Mark is it's really simple. You can break Mark's gospel down in two ways. Chapters 1 to chapter 10, Jesus as the servant, okay? Just Jesus as our servant. Chapter 10, the transition is at verse 45 to the end of the gospel of Mark, chapter 16, Jesus as our sacrifice. So Jesus the servant and Jesus our sacrifice. Now let me, before I read our passage this morning, I want to take you back for just a minute and kind of set the stage. The rich young ruler, he has already left Jesus grieving, and we know why, right? Remember, he was extremely wealthy, and Jesus had said to him, knowing his heart, if you're going to follow me, you got to sell all that you own, all of your possessions. Remember, the text says that he was extremely rich, and so he was grieved in his heart. Jesus did not say that to everyone. Matter of fact, Jesus didn't even utter those words to everyone who was rich. But he did utter those words, for whatever reason, knowing their heart, his heart, to the rich young ruler. And he went away grieved. And you remember after that, Jesus taught some very important things to the disciples about wealth and the difficulties of entering the kingdom for the rich, right? He says some things that seem impossible. For it's easier for a camel to walk through the eye of a needle, right, than for a rich man or person to enter the kingdom. Seems impossible, but then he turned to the disciples and says, well, with God, all things are possible. Rich people can go to heaven, but he says it's difficult. And he teaches about this very topic. And he starts at the very end of that interaction with the disciples by saying, but many who are first will be last, and the last first. Now, they're on their way to Jerusalem, and the cross is close by. Jesus knows he's going to die. How much do the disciples know? I'm not sure. We know that there's some confusion here. But they're on the way to Jerusalem. The disciples are with Jesus. And he begins to teach them that the Son of Man is going to be delivered up to the chief priests. He's going to be betrayed. He's going to be delivered up. And he says they're going to hand him over to the Gentiles. And the Gentiles basically, he says, are going to kill him. Matter of fact, the text says that the Gentiles will mock him and spit at him, verse 34 of chapter 10, and scourge him and kill him. But 3 days later, he's going to rise again. The resurrection. He's talking about his death. Well, notice verse 35 in that section. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, obviously they don't get it. Because they ask Jesus a very strange question. They say, or they don't ask him a question, they just say, Lord, give us whatever we ask of you. Jesus says, well, what do you want from me? He says, grant that we sit at your right and at your left in your glory. And really what they're doing is they're asking to be greatest. Think back to that day and that time. If you ask, they're not thinking heavenly kingdom here. They're thinking physical kingdom. And for one in that day to sit at the right and to sit at the left meant that they were the greatest next to the one that was in the middle, the king. There was nobody greater than the one on the right and on the left, but the one in the middle. They don't know what they're asking, and Jesus even says that, right? He says, you don't know what you're asking. He says, are you willing to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? James and John, are you guys willing to be baptized with the baptism referring to his death that I'm about to be baptized with? And what was their answer? Sure. Sure we are. We're willing. Jesus says, it's going to be that way for you. But to sit at my right and to sit at my left, it's not for me to give to you. It's for those that it has been prepared for. We know that this is what the Father had prepared for. Now, if you look at chapter 10 and you skip down all the way to verse 41, the other disciples became indignant. They were angry at James and John for this. And Jesus used that as an opportunity to teach about leadership. He said, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And their great men exercise authority over them. But it's not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, and to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. And we know Jesus taught this, right, in other places, about the idea of serving. Matter of fact, when he was washing the disciples' feet, and you remember on one occasion he asked the question, who's greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? You know the answer to that. In that kingdom and in that world, it was the one who reclined at the table who was the greatest. But Jesus says to them, I'm among you as the one who serves. Leaving them the example of what biblical leadership is. I think what we find is that Jesus doesn't want them to think they're too big to serve, because if you're too big to serve, you're too small to lead. To lead the way God wanted them to lead. The way Jesus wanted the disciples to lead. To lead by example. To lead and influence. A Christian man, I read about this years ago in a book. He met with people of the congregation, and he met with them for the purpose to try to encourage this group to be at a leadership, upcoming leadership conference or class that was taking place. And he wanted to motivate them to be there. They had a question and answer session, and during the question and answer session, a man stood up and he was being very serious. He wasn't being disrespectful at all by the question, but he asked the question, why should I want to be a leader? He didn't ask a question about where or what they're going to be talking about. He asked the question, why should I want to be a leader? Now, the man who was leading the meeting was very surprised by that question. That wasn't a question he was expecting to have to answer. But he realized it was a very good question. And it's a question, truthfully, that every one of us claiming the name of Christ as a Christian needs to think about and needs to answer. Why should I want to be a leader? And that's not a question for that's gender specific either. That's not a question for just you men. That's a question for everybody claiming the name of Christ. Why should I want to be a leader? Because remember, biblical leadership is servant leadership. And every one of us who has been called by the gospel has been called to be a servant, right? To follow in the footsteps of Jesus himself. We're going to answer that question this morning, why I should want to be a leader. But before we do, I want to try to break down and define leadership in this lesson. And I've broken it down in two ways for my simple mind. I know there's a lot of resources out there, a lot of people a lot smarter than me in the world that have written books on leadership and how to break down the different styles of leadership. But I'm going to break them down this way. And I'm going to include all leadership besides biblical leadership as business leadership or leadership, the business of the world, whatever that is. Being a business, being military leadership, right? In the military, nationally or politically, the leadership there, the business world leadership, and biblical leadership. Now, I think it's very important to note that they can cross over. There are businesses and leadership in this world that try to follow the model of Christ. You know that, right? That try to follow the model of servant leadership. But they don't always cross over. Some of the principles are used, but they're not the same. Business leadership, leadership in this world, and leadership in the Bible are not the same. They're different. And I think the biggest difference we would note really comes down to who it is that's at the top, right? In a business, we know you've got the CEO. In military, we know you got the general. And we know we've got the commander-in-chief of our nation. We see that pecking order, right? But in biblical leadership, we know there's one at the top and who will always be at the top, and everything flows down from that one, and that's Jesus. That he is the one who has all authority, right? All authority has been given to him in heaven and on earth. Remember Matthew chapter 28 and 18 and verse following, the Great Commission there. So you have business leadership and you have biblical leadership. Let me give you some definitions quickly. I looked it up in Webster's just to get Webster's definition of the general definition of leadership. The position or function of a leader. Well, that's deep. The ability to lead, an act or instinct of leading. So guidance, direction. They prospered under his leadership. It could also be called organizational leadership, right? Leadership of position and titles and specific responsibilities to help the group or organization or the team advance or grow, depending on whatever it is. Blanchard and Hodges, in a book called Lead Like Jesus, when it came to organizational leadership, defined it this way. Organizational leadership operates for a season in an environment of temporary relationships and change. People in positions come and go in organizations for all sorts of reasons. Whom you will be working with or for in a given year can change in an instant. There's business leadership or organizational leadership. How about biblical leadership? Servant leadership, which is relational in nature. I found the best definition on the internet. Servant leadership frees the church of the abuse of power and coercion and promotes mutual respect and love for one another. Servant leaders, notice, seeks to invest himself, or a servant leader seeks to invest himself in the lives of his people so that, as a whole, the church community is challenged to grow. And here's the key to servant leadership. They are challenged to grow to be more like Christ. I submit to us that that's the purpose of all servant leadership. Is our goal not to grow more and more into the likeness and image of Christ? That's what we're striving for. To be more and more like Christ. And that's what biblical leadership is all about. But that still doesn't answer the question why I should want to be a leader. Let's look at three reasons why each one of us, starting with myself and everyone out here, should want to be a leader. Number one, because the challenges we face. That's obvious. There's all kinds. Any challenges today? the problems that are out there that we face in our lives and in the church. You know, they're saying right now that we are in a more difficult time in the church than in the past 100 years. That it's harder right now than it has been for 100 years. Now, I don't know how they determine all of that. I didn't live 100 years ago, so I wouldn't know. But I know how hard it is today. We are facing more problems and larger problems in the church and society than the past 100 years. I mean, I wish I had time to go through every one of these points. But think about the acceptance, how you are being not encouraged, but urged to accept every form of belief, every idea and ideal and religion. Don't say yours is right and theirs is wrong. That's been going on for a long time, the acceptance of every belief. How about the misunderstanding of purpose in our society today and even in the church? Do we really know our purpose? Do I really know my business? As a Christian, do I know my business? And you know, I know there's many reasons for, and we've all been affected by the suicides in our time and in this day and age, the amount of suicides, and it's affected this church. And we don't have every reason for them and the answers to why all this happens, but we do know, research does show, that one of the reasons has to do with this very point. When a people or a society believe that they don't really have a purpose for living, well, what's the point of living? When something goes wrong, then let's just cut it all off. There's no understanding of why I'm here and what the meaning of life is all about. A misunderstanding of purpose. We must know our purpose, church. If you don't know your purpose, think about it. Meditate on it. Pray about it. Ask God to guide you so you will know what your purpose is. And how about the corruption of the family structure? How I could go on and on about this topic. The corruption of the oldest institution known to humanity. For a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That's the oldest institution known to man. And our society and others want to corrupt that? I don't have all the answers as to what's going on either or why all this is happening, but it is happening and we know it. But this one thing I do know, and I know you know this too, that no matter what our society does to the family or whatever our society accepts, it will still take a man and a woman for life to continue. No matter what. You will always need a man and you will always need a woman, because that's from God. That's God's way. That's God's truth. And nothing is going to change that. No argument is going to change that. As we say, it is what it is, because that's from God. How about the challenge? We're looking at the problems we face. How about the materialistic lifestyle that we all have to deal with in America? These are just some of the problems. I love what Harold Taylor, one of the best books on leadership I've ever read, so simple but good. He said, "Our generation now demands the best. If humanity is to be saved and the world spared, then uncommon individuals must emerge to answer the call to leadership and service. Real people, not abstract forces, do make history. The world's hope rests with the individual souls of faith." That's you, church. "Conviction and compassion. It takes servant leadership if we're going to deal with the problems and the challenges that are in this world. That's why we should want to be a leader. And secondly, we should want to be a leader because the future depends upon it. Future of our country, the future of the church depends upon us, and it depends upon leadership. We need direction, don't we? All of us, I need direction. It's been said in different ways, but I like this one, that if the king doesn't rise, the kingdom dies. Now think about that with leadership. That everything towers and everything tumbles on leadership. Now we have that example left for us by the kings, and I know I've shared it several times, especially Sunday nights as we're studying, seeking God, and we're going back in 2 Chronicles and looking at the kings. Go back and look at their example that they left Israel with and their history. Remember, you had a total of 42 kings that were leading the people of God. That kingdom was divided. You had the northern tribe, right, which was called Israel. You had the southern tribe, which was called Judah. And out of 42 total kings, there were only 8 that were good, remember? And out of those 8, remember, not a single one of them came from the north. And when you further study their history, which kingdom tumbled first? It wasn't Judah to the south where the good kings came. It was Israel to the north. And do we think that was a coincidence? No, it was about leadership or the lack thereof. If the king doesn't rise, the kingdom dies. Everything rises and falls on that one thing, leadership. And it proved itself to be true with the people of God long ago. Leadership isn't optional, according to Charles Swindoll in his book on leadership. He said it's essential. Listen to this. He said it is essential for motivation and direction, essential for evaluation and accomplishments. It is the one ingredient essential for the success of any organization. Take away leadership, and it isn't long before confusion replaces vision. Volunteers or employees who once dedicated themselves to the task begin to drift without leadership. Morale erodes, enthusiasm fades. The whole system finally grinds to a halt. Peter Drucker's famous line is both timeless and true. If an enterprise fails to perform, we rightly hire not different workers, but a new president. When there is trouble brewing at the bottom, chances are good that a major part of the problem is at the top. Those were Charles Swindoll's words. I'll also read to you what Taylor said again from his book, Holy Spirit Elders. Strong churches are not born of weak leadership. As the leadership goes, so goes the church. No band of God's people can rise above its leadership. Every church is but the extended shadow of its leaders. Bigger men for better churches must be more than a motto. It must be a fact. When churches flounder, fuss, or fossilize, you can put it down. Leadership is at a crisis. I should want to be a leader because the future of the church depends upon it. And last point, and then the lesson will be yours. And this is the most sobering one to me, because God expects it. God expects from me, not just as a preacher, but as a Christian, He expects me to be a servant leader. And I believe that's the expectation of every follower of Christ. What is leadership but influence? That's what leadership is at the heart of it, isn't it? It is influence. Jesus taught about influence in Matthew chapter 5, 13 to 16, when He said to His followers, "Listen, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Let your light shine in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." That was about leadership. That was about influence. Turner on Christian leadership said, "Leadership is based upon what you say and upon what you do. Therefore, whether we like it or not, the Lord expects us, each member of His church, to say and do those things that will bring Him glory. This is not saying that everyone must do a certain task or accept a specific responsibility. It merely means that you are leading in one way or another. Why not, therefore, prepare yourself to be the best you can possibly be? Study the commands of the Lord. See how many of them apply to you. You'll soon conclude God wants you to lead, because the commands apply to all of us. Taylor said, never underestimate the significance of one individual, one person. Never say, what can one individual do in the church or in society or a nation? One spirit-filled man can chase a thousand, as he is able to do above all that he asks, thinks, by the power that works within him. Joshua 39, verse 19, Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20. History doesn't pivot on the masses, but on the individual. Literature had its Shakespeare. Sculpting had its Michelangelo. Politics had its Lincoln and Reagan. When God wanted man redeemed, he didn't send a star. He sent redemption in a package, and he named it Jesus. The biblical model of leadership seeks not only to build and strengthen the church of today, but also of tomorrow. And I want to close with these thoughts. The day is coming when not just me, but all of us, we will no longer walk through these doors. The day is coming when we will no longer sing. We won't serve, we won't worship God anymore. We won't be able to give of our money and of our time, and we won't be able to visit people and speak a kind word and help a brother or sister out anymore. We won't have an influence anymore. And I think for me, this point is one reason why this Lads to Leaders, as this you see over here in the table, which Lads to Leaders is starting so soon, is so important, because it deals with the next generation in the church. God is not only interested in my generation and your generation, but every generation. And our children, and our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren are going to be left with it all, whatever we leave them. And it'll all be based on leadership or the lack thereof. What will we leave the church? We don't want to be a people who are too big to serve, because then we'll be a people who are too small to lead. Lead as Jesus led. Servant leadership. The call this morning for all of us is to think about our place in this biblical model of leadership, and where we can serve and who we can serve and how we can further God's influence and His kingdom here. Cliff has a song, an invitation song, and he's going to lead us in that song. And if we can assist you, if we can help you become a Christian this morning, if you're ready to obey the gospel, this is the time to do that. Or if we can pray for you, if you have needs, whatever they are, we ask that you come forward as we stand and sing.